you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Dave Gilboa and Neil Blumenthal are the co-founders and co-CEOs of Warby Parker, an online glasses retailer that has grown to become a billion-dollar plus brand in just a few short years. And right out of the gate, thanks to some early press, the pair said that they knew they had a hit on their hands.
So when we got those features in Vogue and GQ, it was literally that moment that the business took off. So we literally scrambled, got the website up. We ended up hitting our first year sales targets in 3 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles in 4 weeks, had a wait list of over 20,000 people. It was mayhem. And the question is, how do we maintain that momentum?
6 years later, the pair have sold millions of glasses throughout the U.S. We spoke with Dave and Neil about how they've grown Warby Parker, their future IPO plans, and a lot more in this episode of Success, How I Did It, a Business Insider podcast about the career paths of some of today's most accomplished people. I'm your host and Business Insider's U.S. Editor-in-Chief, Allison Chantel. Today with us, we have Dave Gilboa and Neil Blumenthal, who are the co-founders and co-CEOs of Warby Parker, a glasses company that's been valued at, what, more than $1 billion these days?
There are rumors out there.
Yeah, the unicorn status has been achieved. We can just say that. So thank you all for coming in. Lots to talk about. I want to go back to where you two first met at Wharton, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about those days. This is where Warby Parker got cooked up, right?
Exactly. We were full-time students getting our MBAs in Philadelphia. We had become close friends in a way that sort of business school often does. And Dave had lost a pair of very expensive glasses. How much did you pay for them?
It was $700. And I'd been working in consulting and finance and then took a few months off to backpack around the world and was in northern Thailand. Happened to leave my glasses on a plane. They were my only pair of glasses. It didn't make sense to me that I was going to have to pay $700 for a new pair of glasses. And so got to campus, was a full-time student, didn't have glasses my whole first semester, was kind of complaining to anyone that would listen about, you know, just kind of wondering why glasses were so expensive.
But you didn't have glasses for the whole first semester. How did you see and do any work? What? This makes no sense.
Did a lot of squinting and I wore contacts sometimes. And then I started chatting with Neil, who'd spent a bunch of time in the eyeglass world, and then kind of light bulbs went off when we started learning more about kind of some of his experiences.
Interesting. I didn't realize that you had been in the glasses eye seeing world before, because I thought, so that was one of my questions is, Dave, didn't you have a bioengineering background? And you had history, Neil, didn't you?
My undergrad, I focused on international relations and history. Yeah, not exactly what you'd expect to start
to
a tech company,
right?
Or a fashion label or what have you. After school, I thought I wanted to work at the State Department, decided I didn't want to go into government, ended up sort of working for this amazing nonprofit social enterprise that would train low-income women to start their own businesses, giving eye exams and selling glasses in their communities throughout the developing world. So I spent 5 years sort of proving out this model, because I don't think most people realize that there's close to 1 billion people on the planet that don't have access to glasses. And if you think about a tool that improves productivity, right, that enables somebody to learn and then enables somebody to work, it's one of the most effective poverty alleviation devices out there.
Interesting. So you guys put your heads together. You have this background experience. You're not able to see at school. And this idea aha moment happens. And there's four of you, right? There's two other co-founders?
Yeah, so the other two co-founders, in addition to me, Neil, are Jeff and Andy. So we spent about a year and a half really formulating the idea that eventually turned into Warby Parker. And I'd been wearing glasses since I was 12 years old. I'd never heard of a company called Luxottica, but they own brands like Ray-Ban, Oakley, Oliver Peoples, Persol, Arnett, and dozens of others. They have the exclusive eyewear licenses to most major fashion labels like Chanel, Prada, Dolce & Gabbana, Ralph Lauren. Most consumers don't realize that when you walk into a Sunglass Hut or Lens Crafters, you see 50 different brands of glasses. But all those brands are owned and produced by the same company that also owns the store that you're standing in, that also owns the vision insurance plan they're using to pay for those glasses. It just didn't make sense to us that that was kind of the only way that you could design, manufacture, and sell glasses to consumers. And before e-commerce was available as a distribution channel, it was really hard to create a vertically integrated brand. Right? If you design glasses and manufacture them.
And explain what vertically integrated means, because it's kind of a buzzword, but you know, it's putting it all under one roof, right?
Yeah, so you know, for us, that means that we're designing the products under, we're doing all the design in-house, we're producing them under our own brand and selling them directly to consumers without any wholesale or any kind of middlemen along the way. And as a result, we'd be able to cut out all the unnecessary licensing fees, all the unnecessary markups, and offer a product that normally costs several hundred dollars and offer it for less than $100 to consumers.
So you all got to work, and you, I think the first money you raised was actually from Wharton, right? You won a business competition there? So it was $2,500 or something?
Yeah, we got a few awards from the school, which was super helpful. We also sort of...
I feel like they must be really, really glad they made that investment now. They're going to get a nice return if they haven't already.
Well, they were really kind, and it was actually... gifts, so it wasn't grand. Really.
Oh no! Investment. Oh no! Poor guys.
We try to pay them back, and I don't know, internships.
Oh man, missed opportunity.
But what we did was the four of us, Jeff, Andy, Dave, and I, sort of got together and said, "Hey, how do we want to do this?" And we decided that we all wanted to be sort of equal partners. We each committed to putting in our life savings, which at the time was about $25,000. And if the company really demanded it, we would each put in an additional $5,000. Of course, it did need that. So we started the business with $120,000. And that enabled us on a shoestring to design our first collection and produce an initial inventory of frames, design a website because we needed some place to sell our glasses, and then hire a PR firm to help us get some attention. And when I say do this on a shoestring, I mean, we used to go to TD Bank, steal pens and steal office supplies from other people. But we were able to get meetings with Vogue and GQ, and we were building this fashion brand, and that's, we want to be in the best men's book, which was GQ, and the best women's fashion book, which is Vogue. And we launched, and the company just took off like a rocket ship.
So you got that at launch. That's pretty hard to get Vogue interested, I would think, in anything for a startup that no one's ever heard of.
I think we were really fortunate for a couple reasons. One is I think, right, founders and CEOs try and often take credit for being the smartest people in the world, but so much is serendipity and timing. We were one of the first of these vertical integrated brands, so the story was really novel. We had this home try-on program, right, where people select five frames, we ship it to you free of cost. That was a completely novel, new idea that, you know, writers could write about. I think we have a very specific design aesthetic, and our frames were beautiful. They were made from and continue to be made from some of the most premium materials, like cellulose acetate, that we work with a 150-year-old family-owned Italian company. We had all the building blocks there. And of course, we had our social mission. So, you know, layer.
So that was in place from the beginning. That's where you give basically a pair of glasses away for everyone that's sold, right?
Exactly.
So that was from launch. You've had that
from day one. I mean, Dave and I and Jeff and Andy, you know, it's one of our first conversations is what type of business do we want to build? And we wanted to build a business that was going to have a positive impact in the world, where we were going to be excited to come to work every day. And as we were thinking about, you know, what does that actually mean in practice? We thought, well, it's an inherent public good to bring down the price of a pair of glasses from $500 to $95 here in the U.S. But we knew that even at $95, there was lots of people that still needed glasses that didn't have them. So we decided, let's commit to distribute a pair of glasses for every pair that we sell, because that would actually be impact.
So that's expensive, especially for a shoestring budget, like you were saying. But how important do you think to getting traction is a social component like that? It's a strategy that Tom's has famously used. A couple of different brands have famously used it.
Yeah, there's no question that we'd be more profitable if we didn't have kind of a social mission
well,
built
you said
into our
profitable. Are you profitable?
As a private company, we don't really talk about that. We've had periods of profitability. Uh-huh. We're investing in a lot of growth right now, and you know, there's no question that kind of the bottom line would look better in the near term if we didn't have these additional expenses. But we really view it as probably the kind of the best return we could, kind of the best long term return we can get on those dollars. And understanding that we're having an impact, we've now distributed millions of pairs of glasses to people in need around the globe, and so we're, you know, 7 years in, have already had a pretty significant impact.
So I just want to go back a little bit to how you all started getting traction in the first place. I'm sure the magazines helped, but as we often find, you can get a bump in press, and then you have to maintain that. So what did your traction look like? When did you actually have a lot of sales rolling in and know that this was going to stick?
So when we got those features in Vogue and GQ, it was literally that moment that the business took off. So we had actually, our website wasn't ready to launch, and the fashion director at GQ calls us up and is like, guys, like the magazine's going to hit newsstands any day now. Where is the website? Because we were going to be in the March issue of GQ, and it was February, and we thought, oh, we have a whole month. And just to show you our naivete, it's like, no, the March issue comes out in February. So we literally scrambled, got the website up. We ended up hitting our first year sales targets in 3 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles.
Your first year targets in 3 weeks.
In 3 weeks.
Wow.
Sold out of our top 15 styles in 4 weeks, had a wait list of over 20,000 people. It was mayhem. And the question is, how do we maintain that momentum? That was all about customer experience. So how do we make every single person have an exceptional experience, even when it's a crappy one? And till to this day, you call Warby Parker and a human being answers the phone within 6 seconds. We have a net promoter score of since inception of in the 80s. I think right now it's like 84. And for those that don't know, net promoter score is a measure of customer satisfaction. To give you a sense, where in the 80s cable companies have negative net promoter scores, and most of their optical retailers are in the single digits. So when we make people happy, they're more likely to tell other people about us. And word of mouth has, since inception, has been the number one driver of sales for us.
So if you all are this successful right out of the gate, I'm sure Luxottica, when they hear about you, is not very pleased. So what was your first interaction with them like? And I'm assuming that they've tried to either crush or buy you.
Their former CEO, Kit, flew up from Milan to meet with us you know, pretty early on in the business, I think kind of a couple of years in. And we, Neil and I went to meet him at their corporate offices, and we kind of told the team, half jokingly, that, you know, here's the address we're going to. If you don't hear from us in 2 hours, send the cops here.
Fair.
But you know, I think they're certainly aware of what we're doing. It's a massive company, and it's an even bigger industry. And so even though we're growing quickly and taking share, you know, they have kind of their established business that's still doing well. And I think there's kind of plenty of room for more than one player in the space.
Mm-hmm. So an interesting thing that you all did when you were setting up your business is you're both here. You're both still co-CEOs. Sometimes people do that for a little bit, sometimes not at all. Usually it's just one. So how does this work? I think I saw you joke on Quora that you flip a coin when you disagree.
Yeah, you know, well, so there were four of us who started the business together. We were friends first. We got a lot of advice from people, you know, really smart people that told us that, yeah, never start a business with friends. You guys are going to end up hating each other, maybe suing each other. You know, four founders is way too many, especially kind of you guys have overlapping skill sets. There's not like there's a technical person and a designer. And you know, we said, yeah, but we really trust and value everyone's contributions here. Let's just figure out how we can be thoughtful about it. And that started, you know, even kind of thinking about future repercussions. So we said, okay, we're all going to be equal partners here, but let's set up a vesting schedule so that if, you know, there are so many opportunities at business school or kind of as we get into this, maybe one person decides they want to pursue something else and they should get kind of credit for time served. And so we had a structure that kind of got all four of us vesting through graduation and also kind of set up some formal structures around feedback. We had 360 reviews. Even when there were four of us, we'd go to kind of our favorite bar. And
how does that work? Yeah, I guess over drinks, right?
Exactly. It's a little awkward at first.
We'd have kind of one person in the hot seat and kind of talk about, you know, how they think are going. And then the other three people would sort of chime
pile
in.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you were going last, that's when you really got it.
Yeah, because everyone's been building up what you've been saying against them for the last half hour or whatever.
Yeah, and you know, a number of us had worked at places like Bain & Company where they have really formalized feedback processes. And so we tried to kind of bring in what we thought was effective from some organizations that we'd been a part of and build that really into the foundation of the team when it was just four of us. And then so we launched the business in February 2010. We graduated that May. And at that point, Jeff and Andy left day-to-day roles. They're still, all four of us are still on the board. Neil and I were going to stay on to run the company, and we had been friends first and then had been operating as kind of four equal partners. And we discussed kind of a bunch of different structures that could make sense. Does it, you know, make sense for one person to be CEO, the other chairman of the board, one person CEO, the other president? Do we even need titles at all? And realized that kind of the most effective way to work together was just continue kind of how things had been going and just think of ourselves as partners. But we wanted to make sure that it wasn't kind of confusing to the team as we hired people, and wanted to avoid a situation where if mom says no, go ask dad kind of thing. And so we tried to be really thoughtful and make sure that kind of every department, everyone in the organization only has a line of reporting into one of us. And so I think we each have six or seven departments that roll up into each of us. But effectively, it works more like a Venn diagram, where if there's kind of a major decision about strategy or brand or e-commerce or and where we're putting retail stores, we're both involved.
Definitely. And it sounds like no investors were scared away by this either. You've raised hundreds of millions of dollars at this point. I guess all they really care about is, are you selling stuff? Are the numbers there?
Frankly, the proof was in the pudding. We didn't raise capital until about a year and a half after launch, when we completed our first round. And we had all this sort of success. I have air quotes up because it was only a year and a half, but it was clear that the business model was working, that we had a brand that resonated. So I think that one of the things that investors always look at is the team.
What do you think is the most critical thing you all did in that first year to really cement yourselves? Was it that press? Was it going to GQ and Vogue? What was the thing that you think made it that you were going to work as a startup?
I think our success does start with the fact that this was a solution to a very real problem, right? If you ask people, how much did you pay for their glasses? They lower their shoulders. They sort of get a little sad and embarrassed by how much they've spent on eyeglasses. So this was a real consumer issue. The timing, again, worked, where this was when e-commerce was on the upswing. We were one of the first sort of digitally native or vertically integrated brands.
And this was also a time where before Facebook had fully monetized, I don't know if people remember, but there used to be these fan pages and you would try and get people to like your page. And with our home try-on program in particular, we saw so many customers would get their home try-on, get their five pairs of frames at home, try them on, take pictures of them, and then post it to Facebook and say, hey, which frame do I look best in? So there was this viral nature to our business that we didn't have to pay for early on. So again, there was some luck there from a timing perspective.
And you all at this point have sold over a million pairs, I think. And that's dated information, I believe. So what's the latest that you can share?
So again, we don't share much about our financials. What we announced was that we've distributed over 2 million pairs of glasses through our Buy a Pair, Give a Pair program.
So a million for you and then a million that you give away would be the implied.
No, multiple millions that we've sold and multiple millions that we've then distributed to people in need. Yeah.
Great. So congrats. That's a huge accomplishment. And in 7 years? It's really fast.
It's been a wild ride.
What have you learned scaling a company to 1,000 plus employees, hundreds of millions raised? That can't be easy to do a first time around. So how have you figured it out?
One of the things that we decided early on that we're building a brand, and for a brand is not just a logo, right? It's not just a visual identity. A brand is a point of view, and that point of view needs to be lived, and it really comes down to the culture of the company, right? When somebody joins Warby Parker, they get a copy of Kerouac's Dharma Bums, because the name Warby Parker comes from two early Jack Kerouac characters, Warby Pepper and Zag Parker. They get pretzels from Martin's Handmade pretzel company, which sells pretzels out of the Union Square Farmers Market, because that was within a block of our very first office and we used to get pretzels from there all the time. I could go on and on, but we've established a bunch of rituals that we think reflect the values and the culture of the company we're trying to build.
So we realized when we were, I think, 20 or 25 people, that we've been hiring a certain type of person that kind of reminded us of ourselves on the founding team a bit. But we hadn't really articulated the criteria or the values that were most important to us as an organization. And so we went through an exercise with the entire company, asked people to write down what are individual values that are important to you in people that you want to associate with in your life, you know, kind of completely outside of work context. And we got over 200 different values and then led kind of a bunch of discussions about which values were the same, which ones were different, which ones were kind of critically important, which ones were nice to haves. And then Neil and I kind of took those and created our core values at Warby Parker. And then a couple of years later, we went through kind of a similar exercise now that we were a couple hundred people and sort of pressure tested those values and made sure that they were still relevant.
So one other thing that I know you do, Dave, I think that you've talked about is, do you still do this 90 minutes a day just for you? No one can interrupt, no one can have meetings with you. What happens in that time? Do you just meditate? how's this good for business?
Yes. Yeah, take an hour and a half nap every day. Neil and I realized, a couple years ago that we got to the office and we were just in back-to-back meetings, like often 16 meetings in a row with no breaks. And it didn't really leave us time to think or prepare for the meetings. And sometimes we were, kind of forced to email while we were in the meetings and just trying to multitask, and wasn't good for anyone. So he met Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, and he mentioned that he schedules 90 minutes of kind of unstructured time in his day. And so went back and grabbed our assistant and said, okay, we need to do this. And I'd say it worked for a while. More and more those 90 minutes tend to get scheduled over as things pop up. But we still try to leave some time in the day where we can think and just kind of not get bogged down in kind of the hamster wheel, or there are always things that we could be doing, always meetings that we can be in. We try to ask ourselves, am I the only person in the company that needs to be in this meeting? If not, maybe someone will just send me notes afterwards, or I'll catch up with someone in a one-on-one. and try to spend kind of more and more time thinking about what we want this company to look like in 2020 and beyond, and focus on kind of bigger strategic initiatives.
Got it. So one thing I wanted to ask you about kind of as we wrap up the interview is just a few things that are happening, trends, both in the startup world and just in the world in general. One thing that I thought would be fun is you all are the glasses pros. What do you think of Snap Spectacles? Are they cool? Are they crap? Are they toys? Are they pretty?
We think they did a very good job at positioning spectacles as a toy and limiting, I think, expectation, which was in stark contrast with Google Glass, right? That, you know, was marketed as this is something you're going to wear 100% of the time. It's going to radically change the world. And those are hard expectations to live up to.
Another one I had for you is Amazon. Amazon keeps touting, you know, we're the number one store for millennials. Everyone's buying everything from us. We're the everything store. Why can't they just crush you?
Yeah, I think Amazon's a company that we have tremendous respect for, and yeah, it's pretty incredible what they continue to achieve as they extend their products and services. I think where they haven't competed yet effectively is in kind of building branded products and experiences. And so, you know, while they certainly have private label offerings, I think in terms of the kind of a holistic, authentic brand that resonates with consumers, that I don't think that's part of their DNA, at least not at this time. I think the other aspect that is a bit more complicated about our business is that for prescription glasses, we have to custom manufacture the product after you order. And that's historically not something that Amazon has done either. Kind of they're really good at delivering products that are prepackaged and getting them to you as quickly as possible. But kind of the mass customization supply chain is not something that I think that they've successfully done in the past.
Okay. And then I had a question too about, let's see. So, okay. You all are, I hate to use the word unicorn because it has gotten a bad connotation, I guess. You know, it's a buzzy word that people use to say when a company has reached a valuation of over $1 billion. What do you think is going to happen to all these companies that have raised so much money, or to most of them?
You know, there are cycles in business, whether they're consumer cycles, whether they're investing cycles, there's no question that over a fairly decent amount of time, it's been a pretty entrepreneur-friendly fundraising environment. And there were some companies that were using equity capital to just sort of put on the marketing spigot and doing things that were not sustainable. I think that we've always tried to build our business in a sustainable way. And an example of that is from a marketing perspective, we're pretty disciplined in that we will only spend the amount of money that will enable us to have positive contribution margin on somebody's first purchase, because you know we don't know necessarily how much is it going to cost for them to get them to buy additional glasses from us or what have you. Whereas there were some other businesses that would be around for 6 months and were projecting that their customers over the next 5 years were going to spend X amount, so you can spend Y amount on marketing to acquire them. So you know, when it is a entrepreneur-friendly investing environment, you know, sometimes there tends to be reckless is maybe too strong of a word, but you know, not disciplined spending. So I think we'll see some. We've already seen, right, some businesses that were high flyers come down to earth. But then there are some really good companies out there that are delivering great value and great experiences, and they'll continue to grow, and their valuations will continue to grow.
Great. And so just to wrap up, you all have built a very great brand very quickly. What's the one piece of advice you would have to someone else who's trying to build an established brand?
From an operational standpoint, Dave and I think a lot about these moments where you feel like you have to take these giant leaps of faith. And there's this, I think, belief that entrepreneurs are these crazy risk takers that, you know, are willing to, you know, jump out of an airplane without a parachute. And it's simply untrue. When we're sort of looking down the cliff and looking into the abyss, we take a step back and we try and break down that decision into a lot smaller ones. Effectively, we de-risk it. So the better analogy than jumping out of an airplane without a parachute would probably be, oh, you know, we actually build, double-check the parachute before jumping out of the airplane, and we jump out of the airplane while the airplane's on the ground.
And then, yeah, the other piece of advice that we often give and try to practice is just to try to just staying focused. And we see a bunch of companies that tend to get distracted. And for us, we were asked all the time, you know, have you thought about selling products other than eyewear? Why aren't you international yet? And you know, we think there are...
But you're not international yet? You sell everything in the U.S.?
Just U.S. and Canada.
Wow.
And it's been very... we think there's a huge global opportunity, and we will tackle that at some point. But we've really just tried to stay maniacally focused on serving our existing customer base before moving on into kind of adjacent opportunities. And, you know, can't think of many businesses that have failed because they were too focused.
And I lied. There's one more question that you guys get all the time. The IPO market, is it beckoning? Is it calling to you now, especially now that Snapchat went out and wasn't so bad?
certainly, I have a lot of people asking us about it. You know, we've raised quite a bit of capital, $215 million. We have a good chunk of that still on our balance sheet. And so, you know, we view an IPO as a financing event, and we don't need capital at the moment. And so we can be kind of patient, and our investors are very happy with kind of the way that the business is going. We're not getting pressure there. So it's probably a path that we'll go down at some point, but not something that we're rushing into.
And but what about liquidity for some of your employees, or for even for you two? It's also a liquidity event. So is that something you think about?
It is.
So 7 years, it tends to be about the time when people get a little bit antsy.
So it's 7 years since our launch, but since we've taken equity investment, it's been six, if that. So a little bit less.
Yeah, so you've got one more year, you're saying?
And, you know, part of the deal when you take venture and financing is that you know, you're committing to have a liquid exit opportunity, you know, we will have that opportunity for our investors. We also think about kind of how we can provide liquidity for our employees, and so it is a path that we'll likely go down, but again, want to make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons with timing that makes sense for us.
Great. Well, thank you both so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.